technology and politics. And what I would like to do is to start out with a description of what modern technology has done to us, for us, and against us. Secondly, to say a word about what the classical writers had to say about technology, that is what I call a traditional view of technology. Thirdly, to contrast this view, this classical view or traditional view, with the modern view of technology, as I'm going to call it. And fourthly, then, to point out how, in my judgment at least, we should handle the technological problem. And that will bring me into a word about the utopia that I'm writing, part of which is concerned with the technological problem. Now, turning to the first point, it's interesting to summarize the last 200 years in terms of the impact of technology on human existence. Since the very beginning, of course, man has been a tool-making animal. So the technology is not the product of the last 200 years. However, the last 200 years have constituted, it seems to me, a difference in degree, which is a difference in kind. There has literally been a technological explosion. And out of this technological explosion, particularly of complex technology, have come certain results, which I'd like to summarize, pro and con. On the pro side, or on the good side, I suppose we could say, this technological explosion has led to an abundance of material goods in the highly industrialized countries which have adopted technology, complex technology, on the alleviation of the hard lot of man, the traditional hard lot of man, in which he spent all of his time grubbing merely for a living and was tired out at the end of the day and collapsed, so to speak. This has been the lot of mankind throughout the centuries, up until fairly recently, or at least to the great majority of mankind. So the technology has in many respects accomplished marvels in the last 200 years. In the way of relieving human beings from back-breaking labor and at least opening the possibility for using part of their time for other than economic purposes and purposes of getting a livelihood. Karl Marx, I think, put it well when he said in the Communist Manifesto that modern technique has accomplished wonders that make the building of the pyramids and some of the things to which we point in ancient times seem like trivia by comparison. This is one side of the development of technology in the last 200 years. The other side, of course, is equally striking. Technology, by and large, the way we have employed it, certainly, has led to pollution of the air, corruption of the waters, and overcrowding in many parts of the world. The population of the world did not reach a billion people until 1830. It took the whole history of mankind to reach a billion people in 1830. Between 1830 and 1930, the second billion people were added. That's 100 years, you see. Between 1930 and 1960, the third billion were added. That's only 30 years. And now we're well on the way to the fourth billion, just after a decade, you see, of 3+ billion people. And the predictions are that we will have some 6 billion at the rate we're growing now or more by the end of the century or by the beginning of the new century. Technology has contributed to this gross explosion in population by, of course, lengthening the period of life, by reducing infant mortality, and by making possible larger numbers of people due to the greater provision for food and for clothing. But at the same time, it has crowded the world and has forced people into these gigantic megalopolitan areas that we misname cities. The impact of technology has depopulated the countryside, forced people off the land, and pushed them into crowded areas. So that we face, for example, in industrialized countries like the United States, the day when there will be almost no farmers left, and everything will be a metropolitan area. We've already reached that stage in some parts of this country. And if one regards a farm life as having social desirability of some sort, even though it may be uneconomical, this becomes, from a social and from many other points of view, a disaster. As Oliver Goldsmith put it in the 18th century, ill fares the land to hastening ills a prey, when wealth accumulates and men decay. And he associated that decay, you see, with concentration of economic power and control in the big cities. This too has been a byproduct of technology. So that you've had a gigantic pollution of the air and the water, a gigantic multiplication of the human race without precedent in history, pressing on resources, a depopulation of the countryside, and a concentration of economic power far beyond that in many previous periods. Let me mention a fourth effect of the explosion of technology. The tendency which has been accelerated to wipe out whole species of God's creatures, botanical species and zoological species. There are, I'm told, only some 600 tigers left on Earth, for example, in the whole world. The lion is becoming increasingly scarce. There are some species that are virtually extinct. And this process of making species extinct has been greatly accelerated in the last 75 or 100 years. As human communities have expanded, they've pushed wildlife back and back, made it impossible for some species to exist. Moreover, the terrible technology of the gun and advanced weaponry has made it possible and probable that we destroy large parts of nature on which man depends for aesthetic and other types of enjoyment. This too has been a product of technological growth. So that you have on the one hand then the possibility of alleviating the hard lot of human beings and labor. On the other hand, you have these many byproducts which seem to be undercutting any benefit that technology may have produced. I might even add another factor on the minus side that some scholars suggest. That is, the technology, once we are committed to it, tends to emphasize constant change and to demand constant change. So that the stability of human existence is eroded and undermined. And with the stability of human existence goes mental health. The argument is that as we multiply our technique and accelerate the rapidity of change without control, that many human beings can't take it. So they crack up, that they require a certain stability, and they require the possibility of putting down roots in a community. And if they're constantly uprooted and forced to move to get new jobs because their old jobs are technologically obsolete, are forced to make radical adjustments to changes in technology that eventually they can no longer remain mentally healthy. At least some scholars point in this direction. This then is the balance sheet, you see, of the technological explosion of the last 200 years. Now, interestingly enough, and I come to my second point, much of the classical writing in political philosophy was suspicious of technology. If you begin with the ancients, for example, with Plato and Aristotle, and end with St. Thomas More in the early part of the 16th century, the attitude to technique was roughly this, that while men, as they move from a primitive state to a more civilized state, will improve their technique and ought to improve their technique and divide their labor more and more so that you get division of labor, that there was a danger in allowing technology to expand indefinitely, just as there was a danger in allowing division of labor to expand indefinitely. Plato and Aristotle alike were suspicious of an indefinite expansion of division of labor and technique and the life of commerce, which often is associated with, of course, with the development of technique. Why were they suspicious? Well, they were suspicious largely because they thought that the element of stability necessary for a human personality to grow and to develop would be undermined. This was one reason. That with the development of complex division of labor and technology would come a money economy, and that money values would tend to take the place of human values. That we think of money values as ends in themselves. And Plato also suggested that with the expansion of the economy, including perhaps technology, that human beings in their insatiable desire for more economic goods would find that they could no longer supply that desire or fulfill that desire in the territory that they possessed. So they have to take a slice of their neighbor's territory, as he puts it, and this would lead to war. This is very interesting that the ancient thinkers would have in part an economic explanation for war, and they associated with becoming too complex in the social structure and in the economic structure, you see. Well, these are some of the reasons then that ancient thinkers were suspicious of an indefinite expansion of technique and an indefinite expansion of division of labor. And I would say this was the hallmark of most thought through St. Thomas More. In his Utopia, you will remember, he too tries to restrict the degree of expansion. His technology is limited. His people living in Utopia have simple wants. He's suspicious of their having too many desires, because if they have too many material desires, they're capacity for spiritual development is lost. And so we often speak of St. Thomas More's Utopia as reactionary in quotes. It's reactionary from the viewpoint of modern attitudes, so to speak, to technology. But it's interesting then that the classical view, by and large, thinks that you have carefully to restrict the degree to which technology expands, and along with technology, commerce and division of labor. They all have to be subjected to political control of one part or another if humanity is to be saved for its true mission, that is, its intellectual and its spiritual development. Now, they may have been wrong, but I think this epitomizes their attitude to the whole problem. Now, what happens when modern times set in how did the ancient conception, the classical conception, of, as I've called it, of technology in relationship to the political community, how did it change? I come to my third point then. When did it begin to change? Well, it began to change, it seems to me, with the writing of Sir Francis Bacon's utopian novel called The New Atlantis, early in the 17th century. Bacon's attitude was quite different from that of Plato and St. Thomas More. For his conception of things was that with the development of science and technique, that the rulers would become technologists and scientists, and they would know what to do, and technology would be the salvation of mankind. He envisioned, you remember all kinds of inventions, including submarines and airplanes. All this was about 1610, you see. And he seemed to suggest that an indefinite expansion of technique would do no harm to human beings, that it would all come out for the best, you see. That the more technique we developed, the more gadgets we had, the more wonderful life would become. Now this is a sharp departure from the traditional view, as I suggested before. And it sets the keynote, it seems to me, for what we're calling the modern view of this problem. Now, there have been modern dissenting views, but by and large, the predominant view, I think, in modern times, up till very recently, up till the last decade, has been roughly this, that every new machine that is invented will bring a net amount of good over evil to mankind, so that you should rejoice every time technique is improved. As far as I can see, for the most part, with some exceptions like the eccentric Jonathan Swift, for example, and he is an eccentric, even weapons of war are looked upon as elements in progress. The human being is supposed to be emancipated by technology, and there are no elements of slavery, no elements of non-emancipation in the development of technique. In the 19th century, for example, you'll get Lord Tennyson in his poem, Locksley Hall, seeing technology expanding almost indefinitely, leading to commerce, then leading to war, and out of war will come harmony somehow, you see. No deliberate control of technology, for technology is always good. In Marxian writings, too, in communist writings in the 19th century, and indeed in the 20th century, you find a similar picture, that technique is with us, it will expand indefinitely, it's a factor that can't be controlled, but out of this factor will come harmony and peace eventually, after a final conflict, which the Marxists postulate. So that the view that you get in Marxism on this point, and in liberalism, is about the same. You have enormous confidence in the machine. And Marx rejoices, for example, when the peasant is liquidated, when the numbers of peasants decline, because he associates the peasantry, with yokelism, you know. A peasant is a country yokel who's stupid, and so on. This is the typical attitude, of course, for those who are committed to the life of technique. And the larger your cities become, the better in the long run, so that you can depopulate the countryside almost indefinitely as technology develops, and you can produce your food through machines, and this is always good. This is the picture that emerges. It's a picture that exists in liberal cultures as well as in communist cultures. There are two kinds of characteristics, I suppose, that you have emerging in both liberal cultures and in communist cultures. The machine has exercised a kind of hypnotic effect on men. It is assumed that the development of the machine is good at whatever cost. Sir C.P. Snow, whose novel some of you may know, said recently in a popular article that as far as he could see, whenever men had the ability to build a new machine, they always did, you see, no matter what its cost. Thus, when they had the ability to go to the moon, they went to the moon, no matter what its cost in dollars and rubles and human suffering. So that in the last 200 years, at least, it's been assumed that technological growth is a given, is a permanent factor to which all of us must adjust. Now, we're not told why we have to adjust to it, you see. We must adjust to it because it's something you can't change. This is epitomized in my life, as some of you may have heard me tell the story before, when I got my grades in late several years ago. And finally the dean's secretary called, and she said, "When will your grades be in?" And I said, "Well, when I finish my papers, well, when will that be?" And I said, "Well, I don't know because it's hard to read illegible writing," and so on. And she said, "Well, can't you give me a date when they probably will be in?" And I said, "Well, maybe next Tuesday if things go well, as it were, so to speak." And then she said very solemnly at that point, illustrating the problem of man's adjustment to the machine, she said, "Well, I certainly hope they will be in by next Tuesday. The machines are waiting." Now, you know, the explanation was not the student, not the convenience of the student, or the convenience of the professor, but the convenience of the machine, you see. Now this has become, you see, the hallmark of both so-called liberal cultures and so-called communist cultures. Man must adjust to the machine, not the machine adjust to man. In other words, the machine is the given to which man must adjust. And this becomes increasingly a theme of popular literature. As in Kurt Vonnegut's Player Piano, for example, where he imagines a world eventually in which the machines take control and most people are thrown out of a job and life becomes meaningless because all the work is done by machines. Now this is where we're moving, see, because of the hypnotic effect that machines seem to have on us and the uncritical way in which we view machines. This is the first, one of the important aspects, then, in the modern view of the machine. I know, for example, that one of the most precious bodies of water in the world is Lake Baikal in the Soviet Union. And a number of years ago, the Soviet industrializers wanted to establish industry on the banks of Lake Baikal. And the conservationists in the Soviet Union said, "No, we have irreplaceable fish and marine life here. It's still primitive. If you industrialize, they'll all be destroyed." But the industrialists said, "No, we want to introduce machinery here to Lake Baikal, and we'll purify the water." The conservationists said, "No." And there was a struggle that went on in Russian ruling circles about Lake Baikal. Who won out? Well, you only have to make one guess. The industrializers won out. See, they always do. As long as you think of technology as a good in itself, this has been a keynote of thought and of our attitudes in the last 200 years. Now, a second characteristic has been that in a large part of the world, it has been assumed that technology is to be introduced primarily out of motives of private profit. This has been true of so-called liberal culture, as it is true of the United States. So that manufacturer X introduces a new machine because he wants to increase his profit. He is not concerned about the social effects of the machine. How many people will it throw out of jobs in Duluth? He introduces the machine, and then later on, the person in Duluth will be told, you're out of a job now. And the person in Duluth will say, why am I out of a job? I've trained for 40 years to do this job. And the other person will have to say, because some man in New York introduced a new machine, you're thrown out of a job. And the person in Duluth may say, but I never was consulted about this. You see, we're supposed to live in a democracy. I was never consulted. Well, that's the effect of the machine, the response will have to be. Now, we'll retrain you if you'll pull up roots from Duluth and move to Florida to be retrained. Isn't that generous? Of course, it doesn't always happen even that way, but sometimes it does. The man in Duluth will say, I don't want to move. My children have grown up in Duluth culture, and I want to remain here. Nevertheless, he's told, but you have to move if you want to make a livelihood, you see. Now, the machine has been introduced, for the most part, without regard to its social and its cultural impact. It's been introduced primarily for purposes of immediate monetary gain. That's been the ethos, particularly of the United States, as it still is today. Even where you have a few attempts, as in the case of the SST, or in the case of atomic energy, often the debate is not public, and the debate, it wasn't the case of the SST, it wasn't the case of the original introduction of atomic energy, it was private debate, you see. Or if the debate is public, it's the debate about segments of the problem. You debate the railroad, or you debate the airplane, or you debate highways, but you don't debate transportation as a whole. So we become more and more subject to technology because we do not try to see the picture as a whole. And we accept the notion, even in a so-called democracy, that the thing that is revolutionizing our lives most thoroughly, the introduction of technology, is not a subject for political control. It's not a subject for political control. We'll be asked to vote on questions such as, shall we build a brick schoolhouse or a frame schoolhouse? What a minor question. What a minor question. Meanwhile, the introduction of the thing that is revolutionizing our lives is left to private profit seekers. Or let me put it another way. The introduction of new technology by this method of the motivation of immediate private profit, regardless of social cost or consequence, that introduction is revolutionizing the traditional American way of life, whatever that is, what the political orators talk about, far more than anything the communists propose to do, far more. And yet the FBI goes out sending out agents to arrest communists for what they purport to want to do to American society. Their attitude to the machine is about what our attitude is, you see. They want more and more of them, too. But the persons who introduce complex technology, which will depopulate the countryside, which will pollute the rivers, which will pollute the air, which will exploit natural resources on a gigantic scale and perhaps make our children's children starve because of this rapidity of exploitation, let's say, these people go scot-free despite the fact that they are revolutionizing life far more than what the communists propose to do. Now this is a very curious kind of attitude, you see. We debate the trivial issues in politics, but we do not debate the major issues in politics. We won't this coming year. This coming election year will be a repeat. We'll talk about Social Security. We'll talk about other minor issues of that sort. And most of the issues, even the minor issues, the candidates will agree, so you won't have any real choice unless you abstain, as I will. Conscientiously abstain, you see, because how can you vote for people who don't even see the main problem, you see? This is typical of American elections. We are as much captive of a monolithic political system, you see, which doesn't get at the roots of problems as the Russians are. Now,